Welcome back to Thinking Cultura. It's me, Jo Yule, previous host of TEDx.Vila, and we're here on Open Lab for yet another installment of this week's show. I'm back in your ears every week from 6 p.m. And today, we're stepping away from the dance floor myth of Ibiza and into something much older and arguably more radical. My guest is Dan Cohen, an educator, translator, and cultural thinker who spent decades living on the island and doing something no one else has done in English, translating and interpreting Ibiza's traditional folktales, the rondeus, first collected in the early 1950s by Balearic folklorist Juan Castillo Gauch. These are stories about ordinary people using wit, ethics, and collective intelligence to survive, not to get rich, not to dominate, but to restore balance. So the question is, what do these stories still have to say to us now in a hyper-global, hyper-unequal Ibiza? We're about to find out. Dan, welcome to Open Lab.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've been on the island for about three decades now. How did you end up coming here originally?
My wife was transferred as a teacher and I came along. Didn't want to be without her.
So what was it that first got you sort of looking into these rondeus stories, and how did that come about?
A good friend of mine recommended them, said they're very interesting to read. So I got one volume and I started reading it. I said, I wonder if there are more volumes. And eventually I read all seven and I loved them. They're very clever, they're original, and they're humorous. So I enjoyed them a lot.
And so for people that have never obviously read them personally, like me, what exactly are they and why are they so important that you wanted to translate all seven volumes?
Well, they are traditional folk tales, but they have things which are unusual. For example, Jesus and St. Peter go walking around the island as ordinary people. And it's not people who are looking for fame and fortune. It's people who are just living their lives. So that's, I thought it was a very interesting way of looking at life.
I mean, you're the only English language scholar to have studied these stories in depth. So what does being an outsider give you, and what does it complicate?
Well, what it complicates is there's a lot of the backstory which the people who have been born and raised on the island would know automatically. But on the other hand, since I don't have that assumed, I can look at it and say, wait, what's this doing here? Why is it here? Why is it important? And it gives me a different perspective, which I think has been very useful. And then when I need the local perspective, Juan Albert Rivas, who is a language expert for the Ibiza Island Council, has always been there to say, no, let's look at this again. This is the way you translate. This is what it really means. And over the last 30 years, we've had a constant communication about the stories the whole time I was translating.
So you say it's changed their perspective. Like, in what way?
No, it changed that I have a different perspective on the stories than a local would have, because I'm not looking at things where I say, I grew up with this. It's all new to me. So when I see the characters, I'm not automatically picturing them because I've heard them since I was 3 years old. I'm looking at them in a new way. And I think that's very useful when I'm doing the translating.
So, you know, these aren't stories that are cute bedtime tales. They're sharp, moral, sometimes brutal. What surprises people most when they actually hear them?
I think one of the things is that you find Jesus and St. Peter walking around. They're not normal characters in stories. And then another is that the people are dealing with all kinds of situations, but as if it's all ordinary stuff. So a fisherman goes out and he runs into the devil. Okay. So there's a devil. It's not a problem. It's not something, it's the devil. It's, okay, that's one more problem I have to deal with. And that kind of attitude, I think, is a very interesting one, and it's very typical for the way the Ibizans looked at things. Things come and you deal with them. You don't stop in awe of the devil or the king or anyone else. You just deal with it.
How do you deal with it?
Well, in the case of the devil and the fisherman, he said, all right, you fooled me once, I'll fool you the next time. And then he said, all right, now we're even. Now get out of my life. I don't want to see you anymore. But it's not that he was in awe or in shock. He just said, here's my problem. What can I do to solve it? And I think that idea that you just have to get on with your business, find a way to solve it and keep going is very important. because you're in a situation where if you stop too long, you're in a subsistence society. You disappear.
So many of these stories center on poor people using intelligence rather than power. So what does that tell us, do you think, about the values of Abitha at that time?
I think that the big value, you want to survive and you don't have power. What little power there is up in Dalvila. And so what you have is your wits and the collaboration of the people around you. So if you all work together, if you're good, you can get ahead. If you're an evil person or you try and push too hard, something bad's going to happen. It's not going to work out.
How would you describe the power of Dalvila back then?
Far away. Most of the time it's far away. If you go in, to get to the real power is not easy. It's far away. That's the biggest thing. In the stories, there are a couple stories where there's a king, which has never existed in Ibiza. So I assume their stories have been brought in and adapted. But you don't see that the power is there as a dominating power, just off somewhere. He has a title of being the king. He has a title of being the lord or whatever. But you don't see it as power as you would in the folk tales from Northern Europe, for example.
How loosely on reality are these stories based?
It varies. There are some which are based on very real characters, and you know their names, where they were born, and it was even to the point where I was discussing one of them with one of my Ibizan friends, and I mentioned, he said, no, you have the wrong town. Ever since I was little, they've been telling me that story, and he was from a different town. So they're somewhere it is very, very real. Some are obviously adapted from stories from all around Europe. And then others are characters who could easily be real, although we don't have real names and places for them. We have a variety there.
These stories come from a more homogenous, less unequal Ibiza. And I think when you look at the island today, what would you say clashes or resonates most?
I think that what you just said, it was once a very homogenous society. And now it's a very unequal society. It's separated in terms of wealth. It's separated in terms of languages. It's separated in terms of cultures. There are a million divisions which didn't exist before. Before, almost everyone was a subsistence farmer, and a few people had a little bit more land than others, but you didn't have the kinds of divisions. Everyone had more or less the same culture. Everyone had more or less the same. Everyone had the same language, the same religion. The culture was very, very homogenous, and now it isn't.
I think sometimes with folklore, there's a danger of sort of like romanticizing the past. Would you say that was the case in these volumes?
I don't think so. I think that people have pretty hard lives in the stories, and usually they end up okay. Well, that's wonderful, but they don't end up marrying the prince. Well, there's one story somebody marries the princess, but normally they don't marry the princess. They don't marry the prince. They don't come out rich. And sometimes they come out a little worse than off than before because they tried to get ahead when they shouldn't have. So, I mean, they're very moralistic, but it's not a situation where everyone's saying, oh, wow, we're going to get ahead, we're going to become fantastic with these stories.
This is something that's obviously inspired you to write a TED Talk. So there must be something about these stories that's pretty captivating to have actually caught your attention for the best part of 3 decades.
The stories, I think, are fascinating to read. I read them and I read them again. And on the one hand, I like them because they're funny, but also they have things to say. And that's what the TED Talk's about. You know, what do these stories have to say to our modern Ibiza?
translation, by its very nature, sometimes isn't neutral. So I think, what's the hardest thing to translate? The language, the humor, the morality, or would you say it's more like the worldview?
I think the hardest thing was probably the language, because there are lots of expressions which are very, very local. So, say, I had the fortune that Juan Albert Rivas was there, and I would read a story, and I said, wait a second, I have no idea what that means. And I look at all the dictionaries I had, because in those days there was no internet, couldn't find it. And in the newspaper, I saw there was a guy who said, I can help you with your problems with the language. So I called him up, and he explained something to me. And 2 days later, I called him up again, and he explained. And 2 days later, I called him up. He said, wait a second, where do you live? And I told him, you're 5 minutes from my office. Come in. And so I went in, and we had a long chat. I explained what I was doing. He helped me a lot. He gave me a lot of places where I could look for more information. And ever since then, whenever I've had a problem, he's always there to say, here's how you can do it. But there's lots of language which is peculiar to the island. Some of it is peculiar to that particular time and on the island, and it assumes you know something about the island's past, which I didn't. That was a big problem which I had to work with.
Who is this man? Do we know him?
His name is Juan Albert Rivas. He's now retired, but for many years he was the language expert at the Ibiza Island Council.
But you literally found him through the newspaper?
Yes. One of the services they had is to try and promote the local language. He offered to advise people and help people who are having trouble with language. And seeing that in the newspaper, I said, wow, that's just what I need. And he was very happy to help. And since then, we've become friends and been back and forth with things over the last 30 years.
Give us an example of one of the phrases that you couldn't quite wrap your translation skills around.
There's one, they say, Mac de Fertrons, which it comes from a rock which was left outside the church for people to leave their arms because they couldn't go into church armed, but it's come to mean the butt of jokes. But there's no way you can get from one to the other unless somebody's there to tell you a little bit about how it formed and what it really means, because the words don't translate.
Interesting. And why did they have to leave the rock outside the door in case they were going to hurt somebody with it?
Because they didn't want people to say, this is where you leave your arms when you go into church. You can't go into church armed. So there was a stone, which was called the mac, and that's where you left your weapons. And it says the fertrons, which is making noise like a thunderclap, because every once in a while, a gun would go off when it was sitting on the stone.
So random. And then it means that you're the butt of somebody's joke.
Yes. Do I know why? No. This is why I say it. One of the biggest problems with translating is the expressions which don't seem to make sense going from their language to your language.
What kind of translation do you do aside from obviously this wonderful work with the folklore and the tales of Ibiza?
I've translated for different magazines here, and people will say, can you give me a hand with something? But I don't translate as a living. As a living, I've been a teacher. So the translating is just something I do as a hobby to help people out.
I was going to say, is this your sort of like your full-time position?
No. I've taught English, science, and mathematics for my whole life. And the translating is just something I did with the stories. I see a story which I really like and say, I know somebody who'd like to read that story, but they can't. So I translate it for them. That's what I like to do that, because I like people to be able to read these stories, which I think are very, very good.
Well, that's a really beautiful thing that you do for people. I mean, there's no way I probably would ever be of the standard to be able to understand something fully in Spanish, and particularly not with all those kind of strange isms that are obviously buried in there as well.
Yes, and on top of that, this isn't Spanish. This is in Catalan, the Ibizan dialect of Catalan. So it's something which not a lot of people know. Certainly not a lot of the foreigners on the island know. So it's been nice. I put it into English, and then it's available. And then I've done the same thing with other stories which I've run into, which I thought, oh, that's a really good story. Let me turn it into English. Or then my wife's family said, but some of the stories, you translate them into English, but we can't read them, so I've translated them into Spanish for them.
How much time do you think you've spent on all these different versions that you've created?
I haven't got the slightest idea. A lot of time, but It's something that I've done since for a long time. And when my daughters were growing up, I would always read their stories in English. And so if I had a book and it was in Spanish, I just had to translate it as I was going. So translating is something I do a lot, whether I want to or not.
How important do you think it is to preserve the Ibethan dialect of Catalan, for example?
It's a very nice thing to have. Some of my local friends say that it's going to die because what they want to do, if they want to have Catalan as the real language on the island, and most of the teachers are not from Ibiza, they're going to be teaching with the Mallorcan version of Catalan or the Valencian version. There won't be many people with the Ibizan version. And so, to a large extent, I think it's going to stay in a few small number of families and in the literature, which is one of the reasons that keeping this literature alive is so important. It's the repository of this dialect.
I mean, obviously, the theme this year is Thinking Cultura, and it's, you know, one of the ways that we can really, I guess, educate children and the future generations and just, you know, people that are probably not from the island that obviously are in abundance here. And I think if it wasn't for the work that people like you do on transcriptions and texts like this, then that would be something that's obsolete.
Yeah, I think that if without the translations, it's a lot of this information is not going to be available. I worked with the folk tales, but there is a lot of material which is produced every year in the Ibizan dialect, and most of it is not available to anybody except for the people who can read the Ibizan dialect. So the Institute for Ibizan Studies puts out an almanac every year which has 30 or 40 articles, and some are very good, but they're not available to the public. So what are we going to do? Are we going to try and teach the future generations the Catalan with the, and especially the Ibizan dialect? Are we going to trust to translations? Or are we just going to say, well, we have two different worlds here? I don't know what the solution is going to be.
It's a very difficult one because, you know, a lot of the schools, or most of the schools really, particularly the local schools, want the kids to learn this skill to be able to speak Catalan. So, you know, clearly that's not something that's been overruled thus far.
No, the schools are working very hard to make Catalan the teaching language. They're also working very hard to get English up to a good level. But also, being quite honest, a lot of the things which are being written are not being read by people outside of a relatively small community. And there's a community which might be interested, but they just never see them. They're not available to everyone because they come out in a small number of publications which most people never see. But I think that's probably the same in any country. There's a huge amount of the information which comes out which most people never see because they're busy with their day-to-day lives, which doesn't include reading out that kind of journal, that kind of material.
Fascinating. I don't know. My Catalan does definitely need some work. I think in terms of the many of the Rondais punish greed or arrogance, and if these stories are written today, who do you think would be the main protagonists or villains in Ibiza?
Well, the villains would almost certainly be included in the people who have these huge villas where they are taking 8 trucks of water every day to fill their swimming pools, and they have the parties going on every day, like it or not, driving the neighbors crazy. They're going to be the bad people. Then the good people are going to be the people who are trying to just make a living and get by every day. They're going to be the people who have to find the solution, and they will. Somehow, in this, if they had modern versions of folktales, they'd find a way.
Are you tempted to write one?
No, I did some modern folktales, but not this modern. They were done, I don't know, 25 years ago. I don't know if I would want to try and start with something new. I have other projects I'm working on. That's not a priority at the moment.
But do you still write?
Yes. Every year I publish one story in the almanac put out by the Institute for Ibizan Studies.
What was the most recent one?
The most recent one was retelling of a story a friend of mine told me of when he came to Ibiza in the 70s. And everyone thought that he was a hippie. And he said, I'm not a hippie. I'm sailing with a group of my friends. And so it was an interesting confusion because the aspect of the physical aspect of these people made all the locals think one thing, and their view of themselves is completely different.
As someone who has actually been here for 30 years, how do you think you would define a hippie then?
I wouldn't define a hippie based on EBS. I would define a hippie based on the States in the 60s. I don't know how I would define them. The flower children, the music, the protests. The one thing which was important was in Ibiza was the idea of, which was also with the hippies, was live and let live. And that was a very big thing here. That's one of the mottos that they had, that people think of when they think of Ibiza in those days, that people came in, they were radically different from anything you'd ever, the people here had ever seen. But for the most part, don't cause problems, there's no problem. If you cause problems, then we have real problems. And so normally the hippies just lived their lives and nobody cared much. But when they didn't understand some basic rules about Ibiza, for example, your water is what you get from the rain. So if you take a shower for an hour each morning, your cistern will run dry and there's no water for anyone in the house. That's a problem. So we have to deal with that. You have to have a crash course in becoming an Ibizan, or you have to leave.
Thank you.
the biggest lessons you've learned from translating the Rondeuse? As you just pointed out, there's a very valuable one about the lack of water, although not so much at the moment because we've probably had one of the wettest winters on record.
Well, we have, but my guess is that come July, we're going to be running low on water again because there are a lot of people who haven't learned the lesson and they continue to say, well, if I have 3 swimming pools and I rent my house by weeks, then every week I have to refill all my swimming pools. And the fact that this is a Mediterranean climate doesn't mean I can't have my beautiful grass lawn, which needs watering every day. So a lot of the people who have come to the islands still don't have the idea of we're on a small island with limited resources and we have to watch out for that. They say, no, I want to do this and I can do it. If I have the money, I can do it. And that's one of the things which the folktales say, no, that's not true. There are limits. And the limits are not set by the amount of money. The limits are set by the world. The world has the resources it has. It has the possibilities it has. And you can't go past that.
How do you get hold of these sort of translated copies of the folktales?
I don't know. When they first came out, the Island Council printed, I think, 1,000 copies of each of the 2 volumes. Many, many of them have been given out in trade fairs. And I received a few copies. And when I said I needed some more, they said, well, of the first one we have, I don't think we have any more left. And the second, they gave me 10 more copies, and that about ends our load. So unless they re-edit, I don't think there are any more copies unless someone has them in their private collection.
I was going to say, you've made a collector's item now.
I think so. I have a copy of each volume, and I don't know if I have any left to give to friends. I gave them away fairly quickly. They didn't have many copies, but they've been given away at trade fairs. They've been given away here and there. The public libraries have them, so that's the only place you can get them now, as far as I know.
I think there's some very interesting people that you meet in the library. I gather Joanna Ruby from our speakers committee was the connection as to how you came on board TEDx Ibiza this year. And I know that she spends a lot of time in one particular library very close to Dalvila. I'm wondering if that's where you two met.
No, actually, we met on a hike because I go on a lot of hikes with different groups, and she was on one of them, and we were talking about trying to learn Catalan and trying to get more adapted to the Ibizan culture. And I told her something about the folk. She said, wait, are you the Dan Cohen who translated the story? I said, yes. And that's how we met. So she had, in her research in libraries, she'd run across a copy of the stories in translation, and she'd read at least some of them, so she knew who I was.
It sounds very like Joanna, because she's done quite a bit of translating work herself of various novels, actually, in Ibiza as well, which I think, as you say, you know, is not easy work to do, to translate anything, I don't think, but it takes a lot of passion, I think, and desire to just provide people with the version that they can obviously understand. And it's public service, essentially.
Yeah, well, it's something you really want to people to be able to share what you've really enjoyed, so you do it. And you don't think of it as public service. I'm giving these to my friends so then we can talk about them, because if I just tell them the story, then it's not the same as if they can read it and reflect on it and then we talk. So I think it's as much a selfish thing, because that way I have people I can talk to about the stories.
Like a very personalized book club.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it.
I mean, obviously the T of TEDx stands for technology. And I think in a world driven by algorithms and sound bites, do old oral stories still have the power to shape how we live and behave now?
Definitely. The idea of the narrative is really what's shaping a lot of our world. We hear Trump saying, that's all fake news. That's a folktale, what he's telling us. He's not saying, ignore the data, ignore the technology. Just listen to the general narrative, the story I'm telling you. And we see it with one leader after another. That we're not worried about the science. We're not worried about the technology. I'm selling you a narrative, and you're buying into it. So I'm going to tell you that immigrants are a problem. Don't look at the data. Listen to my narrative. Listen to my folktale. I'm giving you a modern folktale. And The data can say everything against what I've said, but you don't listen to that. Listen to my entire narrative, and many people do.
I think, yeah, it's Mr. Trump is definitely spinning us a few yarns, that's for sure.
No doubt about it. And many people will believe it. And it boggles my mind, but I see people who say, yes, yes. He said that's what he said he was going to do, and that's what he did. He didn't do it, but he tells you he did, and so you believe he did. And he tells you this, and he tells you that, and with no evidence whatsoever, and people believe it. So he is really selling a lot of information, a lot of stories.
Well, he's definitely, one of the best storytellers, but it's just actually frightening how many people tend to actually buy into his strange perspective, ultimately. I think, was there a specific, Rondea, that made you think, okay, this isn't just folklore, this is like an actual philosophy?
No, I don't think there was one. In fact, when I was preparing the talk, I kept changing which ones I wanted to use because I said, well, this is good, but no, this one's better. This one has a detail which I don't like so much if I'm trying to generate and present a whole philosophy. So there's not one particular one. It's the group. And depending on what you want to focus on, I would choose one or another. And depending, of course, on time. TED Talks are a certain amount of time, so that means that some of the stories which I would very much like to use in their entirety, I can't. I have to look for things which can be summarized relatively briefly.
You're the first man on stage, which is always a very brave act to be the first speaker to sort of walk in and give your talk to that audience of like 400 plus people.
I think, no, it's a relief because if I went after some of the other people who are going to be brilliant, mine would look pretty shabby. This way, I can be the first one and everything can go up after that.
You're far too modest. I've heard great things about your talk. I'm very excited to hear it on the day. How long is that talk in the end?
About 10 minutes.
Have you had troubles to try and memorize that? How's that going?
So far, it looks like it's going pretty well. We'll know on the day.
And what does your technique look like for that?
I haven't got the slightest idea. I'm just worried about getting the talk. If I have the talk and I can say it, then people worry about whether there's a technique or not. I've been teaching for my whole life, so I'll talk, and hopefully it'll be more like I'm talking to people than giving a lecture, but I think it'll come out.
Thank you. I mean, obviously the idea of TEDx is that it's a community event, and it's, you know, something that is inspired by this idea of, you know, new ideas worth sharing. So what would you say, you know, if there was a takeaway that someone is going to wander out of the Palacio de Congreso on the 14th of March, what is it that you would like them to remember from that whole 10 minutes?
I think that the old thinking does have some ideas about how to solve the modern problems. I think that's it. You know, we're not forced to look for a solution in the algorithms and in the technology. There are other ways of dealing with problems.
Is there a particular story, perhaps, that you feel that's actually tackled that?
Yeah, that, in fact, I end with one of the stories which tries to tackle that. But again, can't give you too much information.
And how has technology, do you think, sort of infiltrated the world of folklore? How has it, you know, affected, I think, the way that it's maybe shared?
Well, one of the things is that it's now, anything which has been digitalized is now available to everyone. So as things, more and more things, folktales appear online, anybody can get at them. And also with the different online translators, you can at least get an idea of what the stories are about, even if you can't get the whole flavor of them. And I think that's one of the things which I try to do with the translating, is not just get the story across, but get the flavor of the story across, because it's a very peculiar one. It's not just boy meets girl and they live happily ever after. The details and the atmosphere, which slips a little bit when you try and put it through an automatic translator, is what I was really looking for. Because that's what makes these stories especially interesting.
Would you think about, you know, maybe, as you said, there's so few copies left of these incredibly hard pieces of work that you've spent so much of your time putting together. Is that something that you might perhaps consider putting online somewhere so that people can experience them in a shared platform? Or is that completely going against the whole grain of like what you're trying to do?
No, I wouldn't mind doing it, but the publication is the property of the Island Council, so I would have to talk to them. Do they want to put it online? And so at some point I may check that out. Or maybe some of the people who hear the talk will say, oh, I would love to do that. And they'll put some pressure on the council to get them put online.
Well, I really, really now absolutely want to read them. As I said, I very sadly haven't had the opportunity thus far, but I love the idea, as you said, that they are actually in Ibiza's libraries, which are probably, I mean, how busy is it in the library these days in Ibiza? I can't imagine. I mean, I've not been to a library since I came here.
The libraries are usually not very busy, and the librarians are extremely helpful. I work with a number of different libraries, and all of the people couldn't be more helpful. I'm looking for this book. We don't have it. We can order it from another library. Oh, this one looks like something people will be interested in. We can buy it for the library. You have the book here, but here's the book, and if you need it again for longer than the 2 weeks we give to you, just give us a call, send us a WhatsApp, we'll renew it as long as you need it. So they're very, very helpful, and the collections are very good.
That sounds like, yeah, very different story to the one that I used to have back home in England, because I think one of the things that I was absolutely most terrified of was being late taking my library books back, and I always had hundreds of fines when I was a child, and I would always get into a lot of trouble with my parents. I think, okay, lastly, if Ibiza could tell its own story today, we're going to end on this one, what do you think that it would say to us?
If we're talking about the folk tales, I think it would be the situation we have now is not the situation we should have, but there are ways around it, and we'll find them. The Ibizans always find a way.
I love the optimism and the hope that we're going to leave our listeners with this evening on Thinking Cultura here on Open Lab. Dan Cohen, thank you so much for being first on stage at TEDx Ibiza this year. We're very, very excited to see you in action on the day itself. And there are tickets still available at tedx-ibiza.com. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
We'll see you next week at 6 o'clock on Monday.